Hi, I'm Jeff Boothiette, and you're listening to Improv Nerd with Jimmy Curran.
Jimmy Curran's a nerd. Jimmy Curran's an improv nerd. Jimmy Curran's a nerd.
Oh, hey, everybody, this is Jimmy Curran, and you're listening to another episode of Improv Nerd. Do you want to get better at improv but feel stuck in a rut? Does it seem like everyone is having more fun than you? Then stop worrying and start improving. Improv ABCs, the A to Z guide to becoming an unstoppable improviser, is a fun, illustrated book by veteran improviser Ben Noble, loaded with tips and tricks that are so practical and useful you can try them out in your show tonight. This book is for improvisers of all skill levels, delivering a straightforward approach to fundamentals that will improve your play and get you back to having fun on stage. Learn more about this great new book at improvabc.com. That's improvabc.com. Also, do you want to improvise in Music City? Nashville is finally having its own improv festival. The debut of the Third Coast Improv Fest will be held this October 22nd through the 24th. Submissions are now open, and it's just $30 to register. All forms of improv are welcome. Submit now at thirdcoastimprovfest.com. But hurry, submissions close September 30th. In addition, we will have several workshops available from some of the top improvisers from around the country. So come, be a part of what will be the first of many. For more information, go to thirdcoastimprovfest.com. That's thirdcoastimprovfest.com. And don't forget to check out my award-winning improv classes here in Chicago, the Artist Low Comedy, where we teach you before you can be funny, you need to be real. And guess what? You're going to be even funnier. I limit these classes to 12 people, and the fundamentals of Artist Low Comedy starts September 23rd. For more information, go to my website at jimmycurran.com. That's jimmycurran.com. We have got another great episode of Improv Nerd for you, especially if you're into musical improv. Our guest today is Jeff Boothiette, and he is the head of the musical improv program at the Second City Training Center here in Chicago. What I really enjoyed about this episode is Jeff is so accomplished, and he comes from so many different points of view. Certainly as a musical director, but he's also a terrific improviser. He's a songwriter. He has a musical theater background. We talked to Jeff about how he had very little improv experience after he moved to Chicago and how he got on his first musical improv group. We also talked to him about how he feels that musical improv is really evolving and it's really growing up. And, of course, the most important part, and that is the musical improv part of this episode, where Jeff makes me really look good, and it's a master class, really, in musical improv. But before we get to the episode, I just want to say, I don't know if you know this about me, but I'm pretty afraid to try different things. And I know that's probably not a great thing as an improviser. But what I have learned is, if you can speak the fear out loud, you have a much better chance of taking the action. And nothing was more true than last weekend, my wife Lauren and I met our friends Camille and Matthew and their two sons at a water park. And I don't like water, and I don't like parks. I'm afraid of the water, and I don't like to be outside. So water parks is not, two words are not something that I look forward to. But I have to say I had a very good time. And I got to one slide where I was really afraid to go down it. It dropped down. It was probably 15 feet in the air, and it just was like a straight, it went like a straight line right into 12 feet of very deep water. So I wanted to do this. I wanted to get over my fear. So I walked over to the slide, and I walked up the stairs, and then there's a platform at the top. And at the top, there's this, like, lifeguard. And he's, you know, like, too cool for school kind of lifeguard. He's got, like, the aviator shades on. And I started to ask him some questions about, you know, is it, you know, how deep is the water and how far do you go down in the water? And he goes, hey, man, if you were asking me those kind of questions, then I wouldn't do it. And I'm thinking, I didn't want this answer. And so I'm in line, and I turn around, and there's this little girl with blonde ponytails, and she's like, you know, it's really not that scary She goes, you know, once you hit the water, you don't go all the way to the 12 feet down. You go about a couple feet down. And as long as you can swim to the side, you're going to be okay. And I thought to myself, this is what I wanted to hear. And now I couldn't back out. I couldn't get out of the line because, you know, if she's not afraid of doing it, I shouldn't be afraid of doing it. So I said to the guy, I'm going to do it. And so I went down and I held down to the sides. Okay, so that's kind of a, you know, I kind of feel like a little shame about sharing that with you. So I didn't go, but then I went down into the water, into the 12 feet. And the little girl was right. You go about 3 feet, and then I swam to the side, and it was fine. And what I learned from that was saying you're afraid and taking the action are two different things. Just because you're afraid doesn't mean you don't have to take the action. And I think there is a book called Feel the Fear and Do It Anyways. And that's what I did. I know you're going to love this episode. Here it is, the Jeff Boothiette episode. Enjoy.
Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd, oh yeah. Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd.
So, you grew up in Uptown, Massachusetts.
In Upton, yeah.
Upton. Yeah. And you describe yourself as a very introverted kid.
Yes, that is very true.
And you played the piano for 5 hours a day between 3 and 11 years old.
I did.
How did your parents react to that?
Well, that's a really good question. I think at first that they were happy that I had something to do. And then I think after that, they were concerned that I never went outside. But generally supportive, I think. You know, it's a long time to practice the piano. My mother, I think, was very into me. You know, this is my son who plays the piano. And she loved me, and she loved to, like, show me off to guests.
Would she make you like, okay, so-and-so's over at the house, will you play for them?
Yeah, absolutely.
And how'd you feel about that?
Ambivalent. Sometimes it's fine, and sometimes I'm like, I don't want to. I'm like five. Stop
and what kind, what kind of stuff did you play at 5 years old?
I think I played the Entertainer, which is Scott Joplin,
from the Sting. How does that go?
Da 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 da. Yeah, that one. And I played, for Elise, like classical children. Everyone learns for Elise when they're learning piano.
And how did your dad feel about it? Because he was a workaholic and he had long hours.
He was supportive. I just think he would rather have not heard it while he was there.
Did he ever go, like, stop it, stop?
No. Well, no. And only...
Well, tell us the story.
Well, there's not a story so much as it's mostly like singing, I think. Like, would set him off. Because, you know, you work for 10 or 12 hours during the day, and you come home, and you're like, I'm going to watch television and eat whatever pasta. And now my 5-year-old son is singing at the top of his lungs for hours at a time while playing the piano. So I think that the singing was the thing that tipped him over. I think that he would have been fine with just the piano playing, but yeah.
And then it's in 6th and 7th grade, you decide to do your first musical.
Yes.
And this is Godspell.
Yes.
And how did things change for you when you did that?
Well, everything was different. I was suddenly like, oh, this is a thing that people do. I played a pig and a tree and a rock in that production. I was not a named character. I had to create my hippie jeans with... My mother was very instrumental in creating jeans with puff paint and sewing an American flag on the ass.
It almost sounds like your mother was more excited in a lot of ways than you were.
Well, I don't know that she was more excited, but she was, I mean, I feel very lucky because she was like, totally like, you know, let's do this. Like she was, she is someone who definitely is a part of my drive to create. And so I think that, you know, I think that she's someone who doesn't think of herself as creative, maybe, but who has that instinct. And mm-hmm. So I think that, well, she wasn't necessarily going to play an instrument or whatever, but she was super excited that her son.
Did you ever feel like, oh my God, she's pushing too much, just slow down, I'll take it my own time?
No. Well, I mean, like any kid does with their mom, but I played the piano without prompting for 5 hours a day. So there's something else, like... whether it was a gift or a disease, like, that was a thing, right? I would come home and play the piano.
And were you self-taught at this point, or were you taking lessons?
I know I took lessons. Mm-hmm. I took lessons until I was about 10 or 11, and then I stopped taking lessons and just played. Yeah.
But you also said your mom, it was horrifying but supportive at the same point.
Well, I think that as I got older, definitely. Because when you're little, it's like, oh, he's going to do this wonderful thing and play the piano. And then when you're like 14, it's like, oh, he's singing and playing the piano. And what does that mean for his future? Right. So I think there's a turning point.
Was there talks like, okay, you know, let's be honest, this is fun. This is a great hobby, but you've got to have something to fall back on.
The question was not even falling back on. It was like, this is a hobby.
Right.
Yeah. So this is this great thing that you do. Come home, sing Christmas carols and play piano so we can all sing Christmas carols. But maybe not as a career. Like, that's tough.
And you were also, like, ambivalent about this as a career in high school as well, right?
Totally. Well, I mean, I was a smarty pants. Like,
what do you mean by smarty pants?
Like, I was invested in... I was an asshole.
Okay. Which is hard to believe today. But you were give me an example of how you were an asshole.
I was very invested in my own intelligence, mm-hmm. right? Like, I was very, I'm the smart kid, and mm-hmm. I'm going to, you know, get really good grades, and I'm going to, you know... I mean, I was an asshole, like, talk condescendingly to my classmates. Like, what do you do when you're, like, a 13-year-old closeted gay Catholic, right? Mm-hmm. You latch on to the things that you're like, all right, so I can do these things. I can sing and play the piano, and I'm going to get good grades, so everyone else can suck it, right? Basically. So, yeah. So I think that, you know, I was invested in being smart, so I think that part of that was like, oh, I'm going to go do this smart thing that mm-hmm. this, you know, that I'm supposed to do. And so there definitely was ambivalence of like, maybe I shouldn't be thinking about doing music or theater or whatever, because, you know, I'm supposed to change the world through biochemistry. I don't know what.
And how smart, when you say smart, how smart were you?
I was salutatorian of my class.
How many people?
300.
Okay.
Something like that. I was a National Merit Scholar. Now I feel like an asshole now saying these things.
You feel like you're bragging?
Yeah.
Okay, that's probably the Catholicism.
Don't,
yeah. Don't brag. If you've got, you know, if you got honors or awards, I knew that's how I grew up. Hide it. Hide it from your brothers and sisters.
Yeah.
So then when you went to Brandeis, right?
Yes, I did.
Okay. And at this point, you want to be a lawyer, right?
Yeah. When I got there, that was the plan. I was on the fence between law and psychiatry, actually, was the other
option. What was the interest in psychiatry?
You know, in retrospect, I want to say it was like I was interested in human behavior. Mm-hmm. And at the time, I think I just wanted to tell people what to do. Like, I just wanted to be like, here's how you fix your life, because I'm perfect. Like, I was really an asshole. That's not I'm not kidding. Like, I was a jackass. And I feel like part of it was, like, this need to feel like I have answers. Let me give you answers. And I feel like a little bit of, you know, and so I'm like, I'm smart, so I know how to fix this. I know how to help you. And so I think that there is that degree. And also, I loved words, and I loved, you know, so I feel like I then... did very poorly in organic chemistry, and that crushed my psychiatry dreams. So
you know, I like this thing about being an asshole, because I believe I was an asshole too in high school. And what changed for you not being that asshole anymore?
Well, I, you know, a month into being in college, I came out of the closet.
Okay.
I did theater immediately with people. You know, it's your freshman first show that you do. Mm-hmm. Get really, truly wasted for the first time in your life at the cast party. And you make, you know, you connect with people on a different level than the perfectly lovely but superficial connections I had with the gaggle of teenage girls that were my friends in Catholic high school. So, yeah.
And then you decide not to do the law. You start it, and you throw yourself into theater.
Mm-hmm.
And you do very well in theater.
I mean, I think I'm doing it right.
Right. But in college, you
I did many, many shows. I I directed and acted and music directed all, like, probably over the course of college, gosh, 30, 40 shows, like a lot of shows.
Which was great because you could now tell people what to do.
Yeah, I mean, there's truth in that. I'm not going
to
lie.
What do you like about telling people what to do in a theatrical?
Well, I think that it has evolved for me. Like, I feel like now there is a sense of, we are discovering this together, and I am able to be your outside eye or your, like, I feel like it's, I don't know, theater to me is incredibly exciting because we are able to be in theater how we cannot be in life. So in life, we walk around with smiles on our faces, trying to pretend that everything is cool so that people don't see us cry. And in theater, we cry because you hurt me. And so we get to live fully in a way that we don't get to in real life. And I think that that is exciting. And so whatever capacity I'm working in theater, I'm just excited to be in the room, to be having real human experiences in a way that, we have jobs. We have to not cry at our desks or yell at our bosses. Like, we have to be able to be there. So.
And then you come to Chicago mm-hmm. after college. No, you'd taken one workshop with Alan Arkin.
Yeah, just a random workshop.
And you decide you're going to audition for Jazz Hands Across America.
Yeah.
No improv experience?
None.
And what made you think, okay, I can do this?
Well, I can sing.
Mm-hmm.
I knew I could sing. And I knew I was a pretty good musical theater actor. And if in the ways that I wasn't, I was committing to be better. And so I was like, all right, so I don't know, I have a really large faith in my ability to do stuff. I believe that regardless of what the thing is, if you present the challenge and give me enough time, I will figure it out.
Where does that confidence come from?
I have no idea.
Because I would love some of that.
Well, and actually, I think that it relates to my dad. My mom was very encouraging, but my dad was like a model of, like, he has his shit together. Like, you know, when you're a kid and you're like, oh my God, there's this guy that's working all the time and, you know, he's grumpy after 12 hours or whatever. But then when you're an adult, you look back and you're like, but he had his shit together all the fucking time. Like, he worked his way up from a person that was building cabinets at a computer company to, like, a data systems analyst at that computer company to be like VP of network security. Like, it ridiculous. Like, I'm like, there is a model there for me of like, I'm smart enough, I'll figure it out and I'll ask the right people. And I don't know it. I am sure is misplaced. If you ask me to like find a cure for Ebola or something, I'm sure that it would take me too long and too many people would die. I'm not the right person. But I still, there's a little part of me that's like, maybe I have the insight that other people don't. You never know. It could be.
So there is a little of that. I'm smarter than everybody else.
I mean, if you're an asshole, it doesn't go away entirely. Right.
Then, so what happens when you audition for Jazz Hands Across America?
I auditioned for Mike Dakota, who was my predecessor at Second City in this role, and he I auditioned, and he actually looked at the song that I sang because I can't remember what the song is. I wish I could, which I had lifted from a recording and written out the music to, because I liked it and I couldn't find the sheet music to it. So he was, after our audition, he was like, "Did you do this?" And I was like, "Yeah." He's like, good work. And so then he asked me to be an understudy both as an improviser and as a musical director. And I had neither improvised nor music directed at all. But that's how I started.
Were you nervous at that point?
Sure. I mean, yeah, absolutely. I don't know. I was less nervous. I think you're less nervous when you really have no idea what's going on. Like, I didn't know what it entailed. So I was like, sure, I could figure this out, right? So.
And then eventually you become the musical director there, right? And you perform.
Yeah.
Okay.
With Jazz Hands, Mike was always the director and the music director, but I would musical direct when he wasn't there. And And I would also, I became a full cast member. And so, yeah, so I would do both of those things at various times and places.
And then you start to get offered a touring company with Second
City.
Sure,
yeah, absolutely.
And you said the lifestyle wasn't for you.
There are so many great things about touring. It's exciting. You get to meet these super talented people and do shows with them and develop material. I mean, we wrote a Christmas show. But yeah, the road is... I didn't last very long. I lasted like 8 months. Like,
what was it about touring with Second City that you knew it wasn't for you?
I think it was just the pace. It's really, I mean, it's hard to maintain personal relationships in a way. For me, not for everyone. People do it really well, but for me, I just felt like you're never at home, right? If you're gone for 16 or 17 days out of the month, I don't know. I found it difficult.
But you did start doing the boats for Second City.
I did,
and you
yeah.
liked that much better.
Yes. I mean, which okay.
Is, yeah.
I did. I loved doing the boats, but I will say the first one was essentially the beginning of the breakup with my first long-term partner.
Okay.
So there are pluses and minuses.
He wasn't on the boat with
no,
you?
No, no, no.
Okay. It was a long-distance breakup?
Yeah. I mean, we... had like weird issues when we were on the boat, like just communication and like, this is weird, what is happening? And then I came back and we stayed together probably another 6 months, but it never really recovered.
So it's bittersweet.
Yeah.
The first one.
Okay. Yeah, exactly. And then actually the second one is amazing because I had met my now husband 2 months before I got on the boat, and I was like, we're going to do a vacation together, and you're going to be in this tiny cabin with me for 2 weeks, so either we're going to be together forever, or we're going to discover that this is the end, right?
We know how it worked out, because you got married and your husband, but I would imagine, because when I go on a vacation with my wife, I always ruin it. I always get angry at her, and I'm terrified of the intimacy. Mm-hmm. How did you guys get over that? Because what you have is, if you've seen those cabins, they are tiny.
They're very small. We really only had, to my memory, one like real blow-up, and it was exactly that. It was like, I am in your shit too much. Like, this is not good. But... I mean, it was so romantic. It was at the time, Second City had ships in Spain, and you're all around Europe. And so we went to Barcelona, and we went to Portugal, and we went to Morocco, and so it was one of the most romantic things that, like, we have a courtyard in Spain, right? We're like, this is our courtyard. We're gonna come back here. Like, it was incredibly romantic. So I think that either we were in that like beautiful, loving, like, this is the beginning of something huge place, or we just get on really well. But
and then you come back from the boats, and then you become the musical, head of the musical program, right?
Yeah.
At Second City Training Center.
Fairly soon afterwards, yeah. I'm trying to remember how long it was. Probably a year after I got back from that second ship.
So, I mean, it happened. I mean, when you started, musical improv wasn't what it is today.
No,
and the program at Second City wasn't what it is today, and mm-hmm. certainly in the city of Chicago. Here you were, you know, I don't know, maybe 3 or 4 years into the city. Now they're making you the head of the program. How did that feel?
It was great. I mean, I really wanted it. I will say that I have not wanted. I worked. I was just so excited, like. I don't think I've ever prepared for a job interview I prepared for that job interview. I was like, here are the 30 reasons you should hire me. Like,
can you give us a couple?
I was just sort of like, I was just trying to present myself as like, I have, you know, I've administrated in nonprofit. I understand from the performing side. I understand from the music direction side. I also am a trained singer, so I can attack that. Like, I was just like, here are the 1,000 reasons. Please, please, please hire me. So I was really invested in getting that job. Yeah.
And it's also, I mean, it's grown so much.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
You know, how have you seen it change?
You know, well, I mean, I feel like I was part of the community when Mike was working on the growth of it, because it was huge when he took the Second City program from zero, there was literally nothing, to this longer program, and it was incredible. And then I, you know, and that alone was huge. And now since I entered the role, it has grown even more. We've had more students coming in. We've expanded the length of the program a little bit. We've now added in the sort of sketch element, which is really exciting to me because it's like, this is what we do at Second City. And I'm always excited to add more satire, more point of view in. So, and the community, like, now we have, you know, Musical Improv Festival in New York, which has been going strong for a few years now, and it's awesome.
And this one this
and
year?
The now this one in Chicago, which is, you know, incredible.
But Jeff, there's still a huge percentage of improvisers who don't do musical improv for various reasons.
Yes.
How do you see that changing?
Well, I mean, I feel like we preach it, right? I mean, I hope that we do. I certainly preach it. The sort of gospel of you don't have to be a good singer to do good musical improv. You have to be more confident, perhaps, than you are right now, but you don't have to you don't have to become a great singer. It's not about that, you know, and I feel like it's reaching people so that they start to understand how freeing it is. I find it incredibly freeing.
More freeing than just regular improv?
Yeah. I mean, I like to say that I'm lazy, right? So, like, I don't want to think. I don't want to think. But if the piano player starts playing, like, a blues riff, I'm like, oh, great. I know who I am. I know where I am. I know exactly what the point of view of the song is.
So we've got John here, right?
Who's John Wagner, yeah.
John, can you just grab the piano? So can you just explain to us, he's going to play a blues riff, and how you your processes and how you know that?
Sure, great. So we're doing a long-form musical, right?
Okay.
And no one is stepping off the back line. No one is doing anything. We're we're looking with desperation into the eyes of the audience, hoping that something there will inspire us. And then the piano player plays something like, and then I'm immediately like, oh yeah. And now I have no fucking clue what I'm going to sing next, right?
You don't know your character either.
But I do, because okay. Who the hell is this guy, right? He is probably a big guy. He complains about shit. He has a point of view on the world. I don't know specifics yet, but I'm going to discover them in the song.
But that one, oh, you've got all of that from there.
Yeah.
Okay, great. So continue.
Oh, Jesus. I woke up this morning and I thought, what the fuck? Won't start my goddamn pickup truck. I got no way to get to work. So I'm just gonna sit right here and watch Netflix instead. Gotta get me some House of Cards action.
Right. So, what in terms of character, what came for you as you can tell?
Great. So immediate blues. The immediate thing I think of is like, God, life sucks, right? Life sucks. So what is wrong? Well, my pickup truck doesn't work. That's the first thing that is wrong, and that means that I can't get to work. So. Awesome. So great. Now I have to figure out what I'm going to do with my life. Now, it's more fun if someone else comes out and, like, interacts with me in the middle of this, because then I can be like, oh, that's how you feel about my point of view, huh? And so it then becomes, to me, that's where the magic happens, right? Like, I can sing a song. I don't feel as an improviser like I'm a particularly funny person to, like, just stand out there and sing a song to the audience. I can do it. I'm always annoyed if I get pimped into it, but I'll do it. But to me, the magic is like, great. So this is this person that walks like this, talks like this, sings like this, has this point of view, and you're throwing this human being into this mix. And that human being is going to fuck me up. It's just going to, like, everything I do is going to be changed by that person.
So let's take the thing. You're doing the blues thing. And then I come back and I say something like, John, can you just, would I, John, be playing piano on this?
Sure, yeah.
Okay, so I'd be like, stop your complaining. Get a job. I'm sick of paying your share of the rent.
Oh, you know when I met your sister, what the deal was. I said I would marry her, but only if you supported our asses, right? So then I'm like, oh, then we know who we are.
Right.
Yeah.
And I'd be like, I'm not going to support a drunk. The guy who plays the horses. Get a job, get a real job, and put that crack pot down.
Oh, God.
I love to go dark.
I gotcha. Okay. I gotcha. There's only a few things in life that make life worth living, and one of those is sweet, sweet crack.
So
I've never musically improvised in such comfortable chairs.
Okay. And I'm sure people listening to the podcast are going to, they're going to feel the, listen and hear the difference of us, how comfortable we both are totally. In these chairs. You also said to me that you feel that musical improv has grown up.
Yeah.
In what way?
Well, I don't know. I think that in some ways, you know, musical improv really was known as essentially short-form games for a long time. Like, certainly at Second City, we're like, oh, we're going to do a sing-it in our running order. And that's a, and it's so exciting for the audience because the audience is like, oh, my God, they're singing. We haven't heard this before, right? So it becomes almost a gimmick, right? Like, just like blackouts in a running order or anything else that changes up the energy. You're like, oh, gosh, they're improvising
songs. It's freeze tag.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, you know, okay, we'll either end with a freeze tag or we'll end with a singing.
Yeah, totally. And it's an awesome way to, like, it's all about running order management. It's fantastic. But then when you're like, oh, no, I'm going to do a whole show that's just musical improv, then it can't be about this is this new idea anymore because it's not. You're going to see it for 45 minutes or however long. Then it has to become, great, what is this art form? And I feel like the first step was everyone being like, we're going to do long-form musicals. We're going to improvise a whole musical. You know, Nancy Helen Walker with Musical the Musical back in the day.
Out of Boston, didn't she start?
Yeah, I believe so, yeah. And, you know, and then Jazz Hands and other
Baby Wants Candy. And Deltones.
All of those things, you know. You know, and some of them are less or more narrative. But absolutely, and that, and so that becomes like, oh, we're doing musical theater improv. Like, we are mimicking and trying to contribute to the musical theater world through improv. What I see now that excites me and that I'm excited about is, great, so we can do musical theater parody. I have seen so many great musical theater parody shows. What is the next step, right? What if we don't, what if it's not about parody anymore? What if it's, we are human beings living in this world in which we sing? And then maybe we do dramatic musical improv, or I'm part of the Improvised Sondheim Project, so that is all about trying to use words and character psychology in this very specific way. What is the next thing? Because doing sort of presentational musical theater is great, but to me, that's not, like, that is a tool in your tool belt and not the whole kit. That's a metaphor. It's just part of what you're doing, right? So if every single thing you do is, like, turn out to the audience and sing intently, then, like anything else, it's like, okay, we get it, right? So use that when it's smart to use that. One of the times when you're like, oh, this is presentational, and I'm going to use that to my advantage. Oh, this is a beautiful, grounded scene. And if I turn to the audience at this moment, it would break the honesty of this moment. We are still in this world in which you and I are people that want things from each other, and we just happen to be singing. It's like Shakespeare, right? It's not language that we use, but we can still be honest in the middle of it.
And how important is commitment to doing musical improv?
It is all of the important. It is all of it. It is all the thing. The minute that we see in your face that you are not committed or that you are scared, then we lose faith in you. We're like, oh, and when you open your mouth to sing, you're going to die. Like, there's nothing worse than seeing someone being scared in the middle of a song. And what does that to people is the idea of, oh my God, I have to sound good, which you don't. But that's like, oh my God, I have to, like, sound amazing. No, you don't. Or, oh my God, I have to rhyme. You don't. Unless you are playing Do Do Run Run, you do not have to rhyme. And those, to me, like, lyric, like, structure, lyric, and song, like, song technique are the two things that people just are like, oh my God, I'm going to freak out. Well, you can become good at all of those things. All of those are skills. You practice them. You practice them. You get better. I don't consider myself an amazing rhymer, but I am 1,000 times better than I was 5 years ago. But the thing that you can't fake is being brave enough to be like, I'm going to fight through. Whatever is happening in my brain about how scared I am, I'm not going to indulge myself that I'm going to show that in my face. I'm going to commit to, I mean, to me, it comes back to acting. Like, what do you want? Commit to that. Look at your partner. What is going on with them? How does that make you feel? Because you're the reason they feel that way. Commit to that and then figure out the song through that. And don't worry about all the other stuff. All the other stuff is great. You can get good at it, but don't let it be the block.
Okay, so you've got a guinea pig right here. You've got the case study that you just talked about. Because and I've said this before on this podcast. I'm afraid of musical improv. And what you know, I'm a decent singer, not a great singer. Afraid to rhyme. I gotta think it's gotta be funny. And I need help with the commitment piece. So as we were about to improvise, what advice would you give me with the commitment, committing?
To me, the easiest and cleanest way in to commitment is letting your body be changed by the music. So
physically?
Physically.
Okay.
So I'm playing a character, whatever physicalization that character is, whether it's close to myself or for a farther away. The music starts. The best way to find the commitment is to immediately take the music into your body.
So give me an example of that. So you were just, you looked like you were putting your chest out there.
Sure. And it depends on the music too. And I mean, I'm not a dancer. Like if you play salsa, I'm not going to do some dance steps
right.
for you.
What are you comfortable? What would you be comfortable with? Just for a little.
Oh, okay. Sure. Well, and it's just, all it is a simple, like, it's the difference between me just being standing here.
Okay, so you're standing up
for
now.
For me, it's not a huge difference. Like, it's not like, again, it doesn't all have to be like, and the song is starting now. Right? It doesn't have to be that.
You don't have to turn to the audience.
Yeah, I mean, you can if that is what you're doing. It's all about managing, you know, the show that you are doing. But if we're just having a scene and then John plays.
And you're just standing up. Now your chest is up.
It's just owning the music in your body,
okay.
right? Because I'm going to have to sing.
Right.
And if I'm singing like this, I'm going to sing because I'm scared of the words that are coming out.
Right, and your shoulders are slumped, and yeah.
Yeah. So, to me, if you are scared in that moment, if you're playing someone who is scared in that moment, it is always more fun to watch you fight through that moment than it is to indulge in the I'm scared or I feel sorry for myself or whatever it is, right? So, even if, like, I'm playing the scaredest character in the world, but if the music starts, I'm going to try really fucking hard to fight through it, right? Because otherwise, we're going to stare at you judging yourself
right.
for, you know, however long.
Because I totally just go into my head. There's a self, like, if you say, Jimmy, go sing a Frank Sinatra song, no problem. I'll do it, you know. But when it comes to musical theater, I really get in my head.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to try, you know, what
yeah.
you suggested. All right, so we're going to improvise now.
We are.
Okay. Are you looking forward to it?
I am. Okay. I'm a little scared, but I'm
scared
happy.
Too. I'm scared too. I think it helps, don't you, to admit that you're scared?
Absolutely.
Why do you think it does for you?
I think it allows you to move on to the next thing,
mm-hmm.
right? If I'm scared, but I refuse to admit that to myself, then I'm going to be, a little part of me is going to be stuck in that moment,
mm-hmm.
right? If I can be like, oh, I'm scared. Now let me turn my attention onto you.
Right.
It just becomes easier.
I feel the same thing. One less thing on my plate. Let's admit it. We're scared
yeah.
and move on.
Great.
All right. So what do we want to start in terms of suggestion?
Oh, let's get a relationship.
A relationship. And we don't know if we're going to do a series of scenes or one long scene. We're just going to go into music.
Anything can happen.
Okay, great. So we're on the same page with that. Okay, can we have a relationship?
A baker and a customer.
Are we improvising in these chairs?
No, we'll get out of these chairs. We have to get out of these chairs.
Nick.
Jerry.
How are you?
Oh, I've been better than I have in my entire life, and now you're here.
Yeah, I just moved into town.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, I haven't seen you since high school.
Well, lots happened. I mean,
yeah,
look around.
Yeah.
I heard your dad died and left you the bakery.
Man. I was just really enjoying being a baker, and now you gotta bring my dad into it.
Well, you know, your dad was great to me.
Hey, he was great to me, too. He left me this bakery.
You still, what?
What's going on? I mean, you move into town, you don't tell me, you don't let me know, you just show up in my dad's, now mine, bakery.
I've been wandering. I committed a crime.
Holy shit,
yeah.
Jerry.
Yeah.
What kind? Like a felony or a misdemeanor?
A misdemeanor.
Well, okay.
When I was up into Chicago, I shoplifted.
What, did you take like a gallon of milk or something?
I took a gallon of milk and a loaf of bread.
That's super French of you.
Yes. And I'm like, I can't live like this. The police were on to me. So I'm like, so I stole a car and I came down. And I hope you just let me sleep in the back room. You still have that back room, right?
Yeah, I mean, we have a back room.
Just for a couple nights until it clears, until the cops go away.
Hey, you stole a car.
You
gotta own up.
You're my best friend from high school.
Sure, I haven't seen you in 15 years.
I came here, dude. I turned to you because you were gonna help me.
I'm going to help you. The first way that I can help you is to call the police. I'll call Officer Higgins and he'll come over and take you out of my dad's bakery. I can help you by sending you to jail, because otherwise you're a wanted criminal and I'm not gonna harbor you.
That's not the kind of help I was hoping for. We got this back room and nothing's back here but me for the next 4 days.
Why would you come into my back room without even asking? You moved my counter, that's my dad's counter. He made that counter with his hands. Why do you invade my bakery? Why do you invade my life? If you had any self-respect, you would call the police. The phone's right there on top of that pile of dough.
I see what you're telling me to do. A change of life. You always gave me great advice when we were in high school. And this time you're right. I will turn myself in.
Hey, buddy.
Yes.
Turn yourself in. You can stay here after you get out of jail. For as long as you want, as long as you serve your time. I'm still your friend from high school. It may have been 15 years, but I got your back, just not illegally.
I should just pick the phone up?
Yeah.
And just call?
Yeah.
That's it.
You're just gonna own your mistakes, man. Hey. I'll get you a scone. I'll get you a scone. Pick up the phone, I'll get you a scone.
Oh, that's But if... I was the quarterback, and I was popular.
Hey, that was then. This is now. You're a goddamn criminal. Pick up the phone. This is tough love.
Hey, your dad still has a rotary.
He is old-fashioned. We haven't changed the recipe for raspberry scones either. Eat when you call. They'll make it go down easy.
You know what? You're always a good friend to me.
That's what I told you when you walked in the door.
I know, and I feel like, can you just hold it 1 second? I'm going to turn myself in a minute. You
were always there for me. You always, you remember the time in prom when I got Sheila pregnant? And you gave me the money for the abortion?
And drove you across state lines.
Yes. And remember I got kicked out of college in my freshman year?
Sure.
And you're like, hey, you can do it. Go back there.
Sure. And then you went to community college and you eventually got an associate's but never a bachelor's.
Yeah. It was because of you.
That's because I'm a really good friend.
And you know what?
Stop living in the past and listen to my words. Eat the scone. Talk to the nice officer.
This is delicious.
I know.
Hello? Officer Higgins.
That's his name.
It is me that I was a quarterback. I won the championship game.
He doesn't care, just tell him about the car.
Because I'm living in the past. In the future, now I'm in the present.
Now you get it.
I'm starting to listen to what you have to say.
For
once, I'm gonna do something that's good for me.
For once,
I'm gonna do something that's gonna make me feel proud of myself.
Yes, for once, you're gonna not steal any more cars or any more milk.
Best thing I ever did, steal a car.
I'm exhausted.
Thank you so much.
Hey.
I really appreciate it.
What are our high school friends?
I thought when I came in here you'd be pissed off because I haven't called you in years.
Well, I was a little. But then you told me about all the stuff you stole. And then I was like, that's my buddy, right?
Yeah.
That's the guy that I knew. He's made some really poor decisions. But we're here now.
Yeah. We're in the present, not the past. I'm learning, aren't I?
You're in the baby steps.
Yeah. I am sorry about your dad. I didn't come in for the funeral.
Hey, open that bakery case right there.
That one?
Yeah, just open it up.
You sure?
Just open it up. Wait, before you open it, smell it a little. And then once you've gotten it, then you can open it up.
Oh my God.
Right? That's the smell of my dad. That's the smell of his love. That's the smell of 70 years building this bakery. That's the smell of his body.
Oh.
That's the smell of his fingers.
Smells like sir.
Rotting in the ground. But they were once on those pastries.
All of these pastries?
Those are the last pastries that he made before he died.
That's why it says do not touch? Break in case of emergency?
I think this is an emergency. There's an axe right behind the kiss. So eat my dad! Go and eat my dad! Just eat him up, he tastes like love and turmeric.
And lemon butter! Cinnamon too!
Yes, put him in your body.
This tastes like chocolate pudding on a stick.
That's because it's chocolate pudding on a stick. Oh my just God. Eat my dad.
This tastes like sheet cake with sprinkles.
That's what it is. Your neighbor thinks that you're eating.
Oh my God, this is like a chocolate pie with whipped cream on top.
That's the last one. That's the last one. That's the last one. We should eat it together. Friendship, it tastes like.
Yeah.
my God. It's interesting. What was the first song? Do you remember?
I don't. It was...
John, can you join us? You want to grab a chair? And you can help us out. Okay.
Sure. It was the... the first one was about your crime.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. And so I was a little timid on that, you know. There's no fear with you. So when someone's not afraid, you start to lose your fear.
Yeah.
But I was a little timid, but it was interesting because the more after that song, I felt more and more committed to the character. And usually I struggle with being committed when it's non-musical improv, and for whatever reason, throughout this, I got more and more committed to the emotion to the character as well.
Absolutely. And I think that it's hard to get through a song and retreat from it. And we're like, well, we're going to keep going. So if you keep pushing through, then your natural instinct is going to fill that out. Because music improv and music is inherently emotional, right? You can't get away from it. It is really hard to sing the song that's like, there are 30 kinds of leprechauns in the world. The first kind of leprechaun is green. Like, that is a hard song to sing. Like, that is not an easy one. So it becomes really about like, okay, what do I feel about you? How can I push it through? Yeah.
And then the second song we sang was, you remember that? John, do you remember?
That was when you were calling the cops. Right?
Yes, it was.
Yes.
Yeah. We're just trying to get you through the phone call.
Okay. Well, I kind of resisted. Maybe a better choice would have just gone right to the phone call.
Oh, no, I don't. It could have been anything, right? We were playing a game of like circumventing the phone call, which is great. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Cuz it was about us. That's the thing. Like, it's just hard to invent specifics about other stuff. I find it hard. Some people have those kind of brains where they're like, here's my huge list song of 100 things, right? But to me, it's just easier to find what the next thing is by doubling down on how I feel about you.
You made a really great move when I went back to the storeroom in one of the songs. Do you remember which one, John? Was it the first? Where I went and you're not going to see it in the podcast, but I lifted like this imaginary counter and went back there. And then you had an emotional reaction to the counter. It's just a small physical thing, and you made it, and you incorporated it into the song, which I thought was just like really, really great listening. And then what was our third song? Do you remember that?
It was Meeting My Dad.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because I felt at that point, it's like we knew a lot about my character. Mm-hmm. Let's bring something in about you. So so I felt like, okay, let's see if we can explore something with your character.
Yeah.
Was there anything you would have done differently in this?
I don't know. There were a couple of moments where I was searching for structure and I didn't find it.
What do you mean by searching for structure?
I was looking for like a tag or a chorus, something to hang a song on. What was it? The second song had a tag that we hit a couple times that I thought was really
good. Do you remember
lovely.
That?
About as well as you guys.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because we had a chorus in one of the songs.
Yeah.
And I when we went back to sing it the second or third time, I totally blanked on it. Does it ever happen to you?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Okay. And it's just a question of that. That is also another like skill that like we get better at. It's just a really useful skill because it focuses the songs, right? So these songs, not all of the time, but that first song especially felt like a sung scene, which is totally fine. But if we want to find one thing to heighten, it becomes difficult out of a sung scene, right? So structure, whether it's a chorus or a repeated tag or a hook or something, gives you the gift of being like, oh, this is the thing that we're singing about, and so we can just keep heightening.
What would have been a stronger choice instead of singing what we were doing? What would have been a stronger choice in that situation?
I don't know that there is like a definite like stronger choice. I think that if we can figure out, you know, the challenge with creating a structural thing in a duet, especially in one in which we are maybe a little bit adversarial as we were in the first song, the challenge is finding the thing that we can sing, right? In the second song, we found that because we were like, here's this thing, right? We both agree on this thing. In the first one, it was harder
because we weren't finding agreement in the song, and structure is about like agreeing on the thing, right? So sometimes it's even like a question of like understanding that, oh, we're in conflict, but here's the like one nugget that we can sing together, right? Like, so if I don't particularly remember what we sang in that song, but if you were like, I want to stay here, and I was like, no, you can't stay here, you have to turn yourself in, maybe the nugget of the song that we could sing together would be like consequences, right? Or some other like little nuggety thing that this is the thing that we are both talking about, even though we have different points of view on the subject.
Great. So we're going to take some questions now from the audience. If you've got a question about what we just did or for Jeff, here's your opportunity. Byron, is the house lights on?
No.
Okay, can you just turn the house lights on? Great. So a question for Jeff about what we just did or something in general. Yes, right here.
Do you have any projects coming up that you're really excited about in the next few months or year?
Any project you're excited about coming up in the next couple of years, in the next couple of months?
I mean, we just last night opened Improvised Sondheim. We're doing a Sweeney Todd structure. It is a challenging structure, which excites me. And we're trying to find that perfect balance of paying homage to the show, but not replicating the show. And I think we're there. And it's also just a challenging form to play in, just Sondheim in general. And so it makes me excited. So yeah, that's right now what's happening that I'm thinking about. Yeah.
Great. Another question right
here.
What's
a musical archetype you like to play, like the mayor or like the maid? And what's one that you don't play a lot that you wish you played more of?
Archetypes that you like to play, archetypes that you don't like to play.
I don't know that there are some that I like to play and I don't like to play. There are certainly some that I do play more often than others. I often play women a lot. Or like gender ambiguous characters. I often play, I would say, on the other side of that, I often play the like Sweeney Todd type character of like seems okay at first and then there's a lot of murderous rage happening underneath. I would love to play, I don't know, I'm trying to think of what I would love to play more of. I would love to play, that's a hard one. That's a hard one to think about. Yeah, like, I'm trying to think of, like, what musical theater things, I mean, yeah, that's an interesting question. I don't know, I'm excited by musical theater right now in a way that I haven't been in a long time. I'm excited by Fun Home. It makes me really happy.
What is Fun Home?
Fun Home is a show that opened very recently on Broadway, and it is about Alison Bechdel's life. She is a lesbian cartoonist, and it follows her life through three different stages. We see her as a child. She came out in college, and then immediately, 6 months later, her father killed himself, and it was revealed that he was gay. So it's this very complex and dramatic story, but it's told in a really unique way with three different storylines happening simultaneously, essentially. To me, that's where I want musical theater to go more. Like, I think musical theater should always have many things going on in it, but like that and Hamilton, I think, you know, where we're talking about anachronistic musical styles. To Hamilton's about founding fathers, but it's told through rap and hip-hop and actors of color. Like, I think that sort of thing is much more interesting to me than whatever that Tyne Daly musical that was just on Broadway. That's like, as much as I'm sure it's a beautiful musical, like, I just don't want to see that again. I've seen that. And so, that's going to be great. And it's always going to be around. That musical is always going to be around because there's always going to be an audience for it. But it doesn't excite me. Right?
So when you go and you see those shows that excite you, and you come back and you teach classes or you do a show, how do those shows inspire you when you come back to Chicago to teach?
To me, it's a question of two things. One is, how can we in improv be more exciting and committed to our acting? Because it's hard to act in improv. You don't have the time to invest in all of your imagined circumstances, and so you don't have all of this stuff going on underneath. You have to create that in the moment. And so the more that we can delve into that, like, how can I take my partner so incredibly personally and be surprised every moment, that's super exciting to me. And then secondly, form, right? So, you know, if you go through the musical program at Second City, you will be able to improvise a verse chorus song, or hopefully, I hope, you know, and you can pull that out and you can make magic with it. But great, so now we do that, right? So what else is there? And that to me is the like big question, because I feel like now, just now in musical improv, we're like, all right, we got it. We can do this thing. So what else is there, right? I'm excited to see musicals, improvised musicals that don't necessarily start with everyone on stage singing a group chorus number. I'm excited to see improvised musicals where we do a climax of the show that isn't everyone singing, but that is a single person going through a momentous change. Like, I'm excited to see what more is out there. Because it's so new. Like, you compare the length of musical improv life to the length of musical theater life, and musical improv is a tiny toddler. So there's so much growing to do. There's so much growing, and there's so much discovery. It's really exciting. So I'm just like, all right, so great. So we've mastered this thing. And maybe we haven't. We've sort of mastered it. We're trying, though. Like, we know what we... Even if we can't do it flawlessly, we're like, we know what we're going for. Great, so what is the next thing? What is... How can we use the stage? How can we be more theatrical? How can we be more honest? To me, they seem like huge, like somewhat opposite. But to me, those are the two things, right? I want to be more theatrical and more honest in every single moment.
Great. Another question? Yeah.
The conservatories, the improv conservatories in whether it's Second City or IO or the Magnet in New York, they're separated by improv and musical improv, and the different ones have different requirements and levels. What do you think is a perfect balance for, like, can you dive into musical improv without having studied improv? And how, they're just... these two separate columns that somehow need to merge.
That's a hard one. It's complicated because to me, there are certain things that you can really take from musical improv that will just make you a better improviser: emotional commitment and owning yourself on stage and so much stuff. But you also have to be able to do a scene. And if you can't do a scene, it's really hard to then teach you the next thing, right? And that particularly becomes clear if you're trying to do any long-form musical improv. You're like, oh gosh, you were lost. I don't know. I can't do anything about it, right? So I do think it helps to have some kind of grounding in good scene work. You know, and that might mean different things for different people. For musical theater actors and for trained actors in general, I think there is, you get a head start because you understand stagecraft, you understand, like, you know, acting to some degree. And so it becomes then teaching, oh, but how do I get through this scene without, you know, and usually it's just surrender of control, right? That's one of the biggest things that I see in young green improvisers is like, I have to control what's going on in this moment so I don't feel scared about the improv, right? Or the song or anything. So that is a tangent to a question that is a hard one that I'm always thinking about. Because I feel like, you know, in Chicago, there's so much training. Like, you have all of these training programs and all of them offer something unique and interesting and make you a more well-rounded improviser. But there has to be some choices made for the sake of your wallet and your sanity. And so it becomes more about philosophy too, right? Like, am I doing improv for improv's sake? Am I doing improv to establish my point of view as a performer and artist? What is the end goal? And I think that helps, I think, shape from a student's perspective, from a person who runs one of those programs perspective, I'm working on it.
We've got to wrap this up. This has just been so much fun. And we always end our podcast with the same question. What piece of advice would you give somebody starting out in improv today?
To the best of your ability, stop thinking about yourself. Think about the person in front of you. They are your lifeline. Whether you're making up a lyric, making up a melody, or just doing a scene, if you can you can see what is going on with them and own that that has to do with you, then everything else is just gravy. The rules are gravy. The what are we talking about, you know, let's not talk about the past, whatever, the, you know, the old school rules of improv. That's just like, oh, we'll just, we're going in this direction. They're your lifeline. That's a human being in front of you. So what does that mean to you?
Jeff, thank you so much. John, thank you so much. Thank you for being our guest on Improv Nerd.
It was my pleasure. Thank you, guys.
And there you have it. Another episode of Improv Nerd is in the can. And for me, it really felt like a master class in musical improv. And I love that correlation. I'd never experienced that before. But singing makes you more committed emotionally to your character. It was like almost an out-of-body experience, and I had no control over it. And I thought that was really cool. I want to thank our guest, Jeff Boothiet, head of the musical improv program at the Second City Training Center. And I also want to thank the Chicago Musical Improv Festival. It was its first year, and Stacy Smith put this all together. She did such a wonderful job, and brought me involved, got me involved in it, and I'm so honored. And we taped the show at the MCL Theater in Chicago. So I want to thank Stacy, and I want to thank Jeff and all the good people at the MCL Theater for making this possible. Also, I'd like to thank my producer, Dan Schiffmacher, here in Chicago. He's the one who makes me sound so slick and so professional. If it wasn't for Dan, you wouldn't be hearing my voice. Also, if you want more information about me, Jimmy Corain, and my award-winning improv classes here in Chicago, The Art of Slow Comedy, and my Improv Nerd blog, please go to my website, jimmycorain.com. Also, we are on social media. Go to our Facebook page and like Improv Nerd, because it really helps with my low self-esteem. Follow us at improv_nerd, and then our wonderful YouTube channel. Dan does a great job with all the videos. Go to Improv Nerd Podcast on YouTube to see those clips of our shows. Also, we're lucky enough to be part of a podcast collective called feralaudio.com. Check out all the great podcasts on feralaudio.com. I'd like to thank our sponsors today, Improv ABC, the A to Z Guide to Becoming an Unstoppable Improviser. For more information about that wonderful new book, go to improvabc.com. Also, the Third Coast Improv Fest. For more information, go to thirdcoastimprovfest.com. And of course, I want to thank you. And until next time, remember, walk, don't run.
Hello, I'm Kyle Ayers. I'm the host of Never Seen It, the podcast where comedians rewrite famous movies and TV shows they've never seen, and then we give them a read in studio. This is a clip I want to play for you guys from an episode where Langston Kerman rewrites Scarface. He's never seen it, but he wrote a script based on what he thinks he knows about it, and here's a clip. Give it a listen.
All right, Scarface, the new frontier. Interior, happening discotheque. Remember when we called clubs discotheques? LOL, the 70s were crazy. Night. The crowd bustles with young, hot Mexicans who are supposed to be Cuban and all are dressed in butterfly collared shirts and pants that look like JNCO jeans and pleated khakis had a really weird baby. There's sex in the air and Poppy wants a whiff.
Oh my God.
Scarface, 22 to 45.
Like he's a television audience demographic.
Devilishly handsome. Not even a little bit Italian looking, so get that out of your dumb brain. Walks through the crowd with the confidence of a man who's going on MTV Cribs with the Ying Yang Twins one day. Does he actually have a scar on his face? Fuck no. Why would you even ask that? That's not important. What's important is that he is not at all a problematic stereotype and that he has come for his cocaine. As he approaches the red rope of the VIP, pronounced Ve A Pay in Spanish,
oh my God.
He spots his dear friend, who is almost certainly going to become his enemy by the end of the film, Smooth Skin. Scarface yells out his signature line.
Ciao, Bella. It's me, Scarface.
Oh, my God.